God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name. If you want to raise your blue hand or wave at the camera, or Kathy.
Hi, Kathy, alcoholic. I'm on day 6.
All right. Welcome, Kathy. I'm glad you're here. Anybody else? First 30 days? Samantha?
Hi, I'm Samantha. I'm in my first 30 days.
All right. Welcome. Really glad you're here. Let's see. I have the chat set up so that everyone can chat publicly. So if anybody wants to post their phone numbers out there, please feel free to do that. The preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous states that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. Excuse me. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So you guys are here on a great night. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to have Jeff V from Fargo, North Dakota, and to come and tell his story. After Jeff is finished, then around the top of the hour, we'll take a short break. We'll call for announcements. We'll pass the seven tradition basket, et cetera. And then we'll reconvene and spend the remainder of the meeting until roughly 8:25, asking Jeff questions. So please feel free to send a question at any time through the chat to the user questions. And I don't want to take up another moment of Jeff's time. Welcome. Thank you for coming to share tonight.
Thanks, David. My name is Jeff Van Lanningham, and I am an alcoholic. Because of God, AA, and sponsorship, my sobriety date is March 16th, 1992. I'll just save you the trouble. I'll do the math for you because I've literally missed an entire talk trying to figure out how long someone was sober, how old they are, all those things. I just celebrated in March 28 years of sobriety. I was 6 years old when I sobered up. So no, I wasn't six. I was 21 when I sobered up. So I am now 50 years old and 28 years sober. By the way, before I forget, I was told I had this happen last night. It's the first time I've ever had it happen on Zoom. My daughter is here. She's working remote, and there's apparently a big draw on our internet. And last night, what was happening was my audio was just completely going out. Of course, I didn't know that. Was kept talking. So, David, I've got you in my center top Hollywood Squares box there. If my audio goes out, I'll be kind of watching you. If you want to just point to your earphones or something and let me know, and we'll get it rectified. Anyway, thank you so much for asking me to participate here in your meeting. I believe I'm in Virginia tonight. Is that right? Yeah, I think this is my third time in 30 days talking in Virginia. So I don't know what God wants me to glean from Virginia. Maybe I'm supposed to move there. Welcome to the people who acknowledge themselves as being new in their first 30 days. And I think, Kathy, you said you had 6 days. And I know a lot of people are going to, you know, I always hear people say things like, I can't imagine what it must be like to try and sober up during COVID. And it certainly has its challenges. But quite frankly, anytime, there is no opportune time to sober up. Never do you reach a point where you're like, you know what, I really feel like I've done everything I want to do. I've burnt everything down to the ground I want to burn down. I think now is a really good time to sober up. So we're glad you're here. And I want to share a little bit of my story. I guess, you know, there's a lot of ways to go about it. We share in a general way what we were like, what happened, what we're like now. Sometimes they talk about each individual in his or her own way, shares how they develop their relationship with God. What I really want to zero in on, especially if you are new, is this idea that one of my objections to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm assuming this is not your first choice. One of my objections to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous was this deep-seated belief that I'm not really an alcoholic. Now, today, treatment centers have made popular the word denial, and they will say, oh, you were in denial. That's not what was wrong with me. I was under something much more insidious called a delusion. Now, what's the difference? When I was about 30 years old, my hair started to go gray, and I would look in the mirror and I could start to see these gray hairs forming. And I would tell myself this, I would say, oh, my hair is getting lighter. It must be getting lighter from the sun. And look, I live in Fargo. We don't have any sun. I mean, come on. I knew what was going on. I knew what was happening, but I pretend that that's not really what it is. That's not what's wrong with me when it comes to my alcoholism. I'm not in denial. I do not secretly know the truth about myself. I am suffering from a delusion, and a delusion means I buy the lie. All of those times I said to people, you don't understand. It's not the way it looks. I know why you think I'm an alcoholic. I know why you're concerned, but that's not really it. I believed it. I meant it. I had evidence. We all know what an alcoholic is, right? An alcoholic is someone, they drink too much. Eventually, apparently, they can't handle their liquor. So they head down this road of developing defects of character. They have problems in their relationships, jobs, with money. They become selfish, self-centered, fear-driven, whatever. All because they drink too much. And if they can stumble through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and somebody gives them this magical advice, hey, don't take the first drink and you won't get drunk. And that's eye-opener, right? Like, oh, okay. They stop drinking and they return to normal living. Here's my first problem. That's not my story. I have no normal living to return to. I've been screwed up from as far back as I can remember. There has always been something wrong with me. I just didn't know what it was. And even later on, when I would start drinking and drinking would start to cause problems in my life, I would think, I have a drinking solution, not a drinking problem. Now, admittedly, it's a bad solution. I get that. And we'll get that figured out, right? The great obsession of every alcoholic to control and enjoy their drinking. Many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. Isn't that true? Think about how many things are you willing to pursue into the gates of insanity or death? I remember a counselor telling me one time, he said, Jeff, you've got three options. You're going to die, you're going to go insane, or you're going to end up in prison. This was my response. I'm like, I don't want to go to prison, right? That's what insanity and death certainly on the table. I just don't want to end up in prison. But there's been something wrong with me from as far back as I can remember. I feel out of place most times. I feel insecure and inadequate. Nobody's done anything to me to make me feel this way. Nobody's told me I'm not enough. I wasn't raised to believe that. It's just kind of my natural default setting. And I walk around with this feeling of I'm just not where I'm supposed to be. I'm not with the people I should be with. I'm not doing the things I should be doing. And I have all of these little neuroses going on. I have this really racy mind, constantly overanalyzing things. I'm the kind of guy who feels emotions very intensely. I don't get happy. I get ecstatic. I don't get blue. I get suicidal. And oftentimes can bounce from one emotion to the next, depending upon some frivolous, trivial thing going on. I'm a kind of guy who I'm extremely sensitive, and I've spent a lot of my life with my feelings hurt, based not on what people have actually said. I remember meeting a counselor, I don't know, my late teens, and I was telling her how sensitive I am. And she's like, well, it's not uncommon, Jeff, that when people say mean things to you, that, you know, you would have your feelings hurt. And I'm like, yeah, nobody's actually saying anything to me. It's more that I sense that they want to. I have this amazing superpower of reading people's looks, tones of voice. Have you ever felt like everyone else is just genuinely happy to see each other and they tolerate you? You know, like, oh, thank God you're here. Thank God you're, oh, hey, Jeff, how are you, right? By the way, I carried that with me into Alcoholics Anonymous. I become left untreated. I become the guy you walk on eggshells around. I remember going to a meeting one time, and some guy just trying to say hello to me. You know, he's like, "Hey, Jeff, haven't seen you around here in a while. What the hell does that mean? You think you're more active than me?" You know, and I'm teeing off on him. And that's my natural state, right? I'm a kind of guy who, here's a good one. This will separate the real alcoholics from the hard drinkers. I'm the kind of guy who is offended when I am not invited to something that I don't want to be at in the first place. That is really, I mean, you either get that or you don't. You don't read about that in a book, you live it. And, but I'm deeply offended, you know. Someone asked me, "Hey, we were all going over to David's on Friday night to help him move. You coming?" "No, nobody invited me. See, nobody likes me." "Oh, well, you want to come to David's move?" "Hell no, I don't want to come to David's move. David seems like he collects pianos and I don't need any part of that, but I do want to be invited." By the way, that's my natural, believe me, with my sponsor, I'm at David's move, as you'll find out later on in my story. But that's kind of how I'm wired. I am wired needing to be treated special just so I feel average. Just so I feel, if you treat me better than everyone else, I feel like maybe I'm accepted. And once I'm treated or accepted or treated average, I feel like it's rejection. And I continue on down the road. You know, most of my life, if I was to really to describe myself, I would call it a seeker, and not in a good way. I've just been always trying to find where I fit, where my spot is in life, and seemingly I could never find it. When I was 15 years old, I found the answer to what was wrong with me, and it was alcohol, right? And, you know, I remember thinking once upon a time how horrible it was that I started drinking at 15, you know, that alcohol had robbed me of my youth. I've come to believe that's not a big deal. It's not as tragic of a story. I mean, you hear people in AA with 15 years old, they have like 10 years of sobriety. It's like, it's not that big a deal. But at the time when I came in, you know, I thought it was horrible. But alcohol has the ability to change the way I see myself and the world around me, like nothing else ever had. Every hole I feel, every deficiency that I carry, every fear I suffer from, every fictitious anxiety I have, every piece of guilt that I don't know where it comes from, all of it goes away for a little while, right? And that is the power of alcohol on a guy like me. There's a great speaker, many of you probably know him, named Clancy, who just recently left us. And he had a great line about alcohol goes boom to the alcoholic, and to the normal person, it goes boom, boom. Right? And I get that. I know what that boom feeling is like. And I remember going out to a party. I'm sitting there, I'm self-conscious, I'm self-centered, I'm self a lot of things, self-obsessed. And I'm sitting there though, and I'm freaking out, and I'm not, you know, comfortable. And I'm wondering why I came to this party. And this is who I am, right? And it's really, really uncomfortable. And it's going to get worse, because here comes this guy, some guy that I hate, whose looks cool and dressed appropriate, and everybody seems really genuinely happy to see him. I hate people like that, right? And I'm staring daggers at him from across the room because I'm so full of jealousy and inadequacy. And then hot on the heels of that stud, here comes her, right? The girl of my dreams. And I look and I watch her as she walks in, and I think, you know, this is the girl I have been pursuing. And when I say I'm pursuing her, I don't mean I'm taking any action at all, but I think about her a lot. And but I know in my heart that this girl would never be interested in a guy like me, right? And so I'm not going to even bother instigating a conversation, because I mean, on the off chance that she's going to say, "Hey, you know, you're a freak, and how dare you come talk to me?" And everyone's going to laugh at me. And I just don't want to put myself in there, right? And this is who I am. This is the prison that I live in. And then I start drinking, right? And every lock opens up. Every lock opens up, and suddenly I come out into the world. This is the boom part of alcohol. And by the third or fourth drink, I'm feeling completely different, right? I was 45 minutes prior, I was so inadequate. I just wanted to run home. Suddenly I'm looking at this party and I'm thinking to myself, I'm glad I came, because I'm making this party, quite frankly. And now I'm going to start to right wrongs, right? This is my favorite part of the evening. First things first, we're going to go over to the Mr. Cool, who'd showed up about an hour before, you know, with his hat on, and everyone was excited to see him. But now I'm brimming with confidence. And I go over and I'm like, hey, man, about an hour ago, there was a little tension between you and I when you got here. He doesn't know there was tension, by the way. He doesn't know the neurotic fool in the corner was having an imaginary war with him. But anyway, I'm there now, mouthing off, and it feels good, right? And now I'm going to go find her. And I'll tell you what, whew, it's time. And I go find her, and I let her know right off my lead-off line. Listen, I could have anyone I want at this party, male or female, and I'm choosing you. And this is a great honor. And she doesn't, you know, seem to hold that kind of interest. I'm not bothered. I'm not publicly humiliated in anything. I lock her in a bathroom somewhere until she comes to her senses. That is what alcohol does for me, right? And that's a powerful thing. Now, I didn't notice. I just thought it did that for everyone, by the way. I'm like, I can't believe we're all not just sitting around drinking all the time. This is amazing stuff. And I've come to believe, of course, that it doesn't do that for most people. That's why those people that suddenly would start dropping off that wouldn't drink like we do, or some of us, is this an open meeting? Somebody, yeah, okay. So we might have some non-alcoholics here, welcome. And if you, by the way, if you are a non-alcoholic, and maybe you're here because of a loved one, maybe you love someone who's an alcoholic, I'm sure you've looked at them and just wanted to pull out your hair and ask the question that we all get asked, why do you do this? Why do you continue to do this? Can't you see what alcohol is doing to you, right? And here's the answer to that. Yes, we're not dumb. We do know what alcohol is doing to us. The problem is, by the time it's doing something to us, and by to us, I mean the consequences of it, the DUIs, the legal troubles, the relationship troubles, by the time it's doing something to us, long before that, it was doing something for us. That's why we go back. That's why we chase this obsession, because I am convinced that somehow, someday, I will get back to when it was good. And it wasn't good very long for me, if I'm honest with you, but alcohol is the only solution I have to a miserable existence. Yes, it's a bad solution. I understand that. But this is where my difference with you comes into play. This is where this idea that I'm not really an alcoholic comes into play, because I just assumed wrongfully that alcohol had to do with people who just have trouble drinking. Because what we love to talk about in AA is the what it does to us. We love the consequence. We love the high-speed chases, the failed bank robberies, all of that stuff. It's fun. It's exciting. And I get it. And I've heard lots of it. But underneath it, there's something much more deadly going on. And it's this elusive, hard to pin down feeling that alcohol does for us. I, of course, didn't know any of that. I continued on my merry way. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, but I've had a lot of things happen to me, right? I've had consequences galore. I've been arrested in Mexico because I was down there drunk and I thought the federales were lipping off to me, and I took offense to that. I'm just going to tell you right now, they are not impressed with drunken, phony, tough guy Americans. And it wasn't long, I was sitting in a Mexican jail, literally crying for my mom. And so that's how tough I get, left to my own devices. I've had two failed suicide attempts. Probably didn't need to see failed in that, now that I think about it, obviously. I one night had gone to a party. This is going to surprise you, but she walked into the room. I was drunk and I thought, okay, now is where I'm finally going to get this right. And I went over and I started talking to her, and somewhere along the lines, it seemed to me it was going well. So something, a little voice inside of me was like, tell this girl the story, the real story, right? The long, unedited, truthful version. So I started telling her my story, how I think about suicide a lot. And now that I met her, I'm not going to do it. I actually thought it was really romantic. Plus then I decided to let her know, because I had been following this gal for about a week, just because I wanted to learn about her. And so I told her, you know, and this was the first time I heard the word stalker used to describe me. And I remember finally she said, look, you scare me and I want you to leave. And man, I didn't understand what the big deal is, but I was mortified. And on my way back to my dorm, something just snapped. Something just snapped inside of me. And I was like, you know, once upon a time, I had so much potential, so much promise. And it's just nothing's working out. And I just want out. So I went back to my dorm. I was taking sleeping pills at the time. I cracked open a bottle, took a handful, and sat back and waited to die. And a buddy of mine showed up, you know, kind of concerned. And I told him what I had done. And he got very, you know, frantic. And he's like, oh, man, we have to go to a hospital so you can see a priest. Because if you don't talk to a priest, your soul can't be admitted to heaven. And I was so drunk that made sense to me, right? I'm like, oh, my God, let's go. You're right. Literally drove myself to the psych ward. I would find out later. And got there and this nurse met us and she was very concerned. And her big thing was she wanted to know what I had taken. And I had brought the bottle, you know, if I wasn't dead soon enough, I was going to take another handful. And so I pulled out the bottle. I remember, and I showed her the bottle and she starts laughing. And I'm like, I remember I had this out of body moment where I was like, look, I know I'm really drunk. But this seems like a really unprofessional reaction to this really, really sad tale here that's going on. And then she held up the bottle. She's like, Jeff, what you took? And she points at it. She goes, what you took were vitamin C tablets. And apparently, you know, I was so drunk, I had grabbed the wrong bottle. And, you know, that got me in the psych ward. By the way, when I say psych ward, this term's getting used far too liberally these days. I was doing some H&I meeting here recently and some guy, we were sitting in a lounge drinking coffee, eating snacks. And this guy's like, yeah, I can't believe I'm in the psych ward. I'm like, whoa, this is not the psych ward. This is some kind of treatment center. The psych ward is where your bed is bolted down. The curtains are on Velcro. They don't give you glass mirrors. They're metal, weird funhouse mirrors where that's the first thing you wake up after a really bad jag. It's like, good God. And then see that distorted reflection of yourself. And that's where I end up, left to my own devices, right? That's what happens to me. My other attempt, I don't talk about it very often, but you'll appreciate this since you live in Virginia. I live in a place, I'd actually done quite a bit of research on suicide. And I had all these reasons why, you know, if you shoot yourself, that doesn't always take. Clearly, I can't OD because I've screwed that up. But freezing to death, right? I had read that what a beautiful way this was to die. Is that you just drift off to sleep. It's painless, supposedly. And, you know, well, I live in Fargo. Perfect. I mean, all I got to do is open a window. And that's what I did one night is just open a window, sat down in a chair. I mean, it was like 20 below and I'm like, good, going to die. And as the night went on, about 10 minutes into it, I started thinking, man, it's really cold. You know, it's like, well, I'm sure nothing. It won't hurt if I get a blanket, right? Because I want my banky. And so now I got a blanket. Anyway, long story short, I woke up the next morning. God, my room was freezing, sick, could have used vitamin C by this time. And again, another failed, suicide attempt. So anyway, and those are the kinds of things that happened to me, right? Just this unbelievable spiral, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization each time, you know, and there were times I would try and quit. Always though, I would quickly justify my way out of it and head back. I got to a point one night I was at a party and I was always hurt. I always just felt like this ugliness inside of me. And then this particular night, just to kind of speed things along, I decided that if I hurt, I want everyone else to hurt too. Because at my core and at my nature, I'm petty and self-centered and fickle. And so I just decided I wanted everyone to hurt. And I started, you know, drunk. I started hurling all these insults at people. And I remember this gal stepped forward and she's like, what's the matter with you? And the truth of the matter, if I was to have been honest that night, the answer would have been, I don't know. I don't want any of this to happen. When I drink, I go places I don't want to go. I hurt people I don't want to hurt. I say things I don't want to say. No, I just wanted to drink to have a good time tonight. I just wanted to take the edge off. I just wanted to get there. And every alcoholic knows where there is. It's where we're always drinking to get. But I don't stay there very long. And now I end up here and this girl is crying and this guy is mad at me, and this is, none of this is what I wanted to happen. But the bottom line is that the best answer I would have had was to say, I don't know. Now, you may be wondering, where then did I smash this delusion that I'm not really an alcoholic? When did I become one? And the answer is quite simple. I became an alcoholic by coming to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. But not just that, I didn't catch it here. I learned to identify here. See, the cool thing about Alcoholics Anonymous that I poke fun at it sometimes, but we don't define alcoholism. We have no official definition. We have no anything, right? We don't tell you if you are or aren't an alcoholic. What we do is say, I'm an alcoholic and here's my story, and you may or may not relate. We give people the freedom and the dignity to make up their own mind as to whether or not they have what we have. And by my listening here, by my listening to your share, I started to identify, ultimately culminating in this ability to concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, or if you like the wording, admit I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. Whatever the case may be, I was allowed to take step one by listening. It wasn't by anyone telling me anything. I just listened. I identified with the way that you drank. I identified with the way that you felt. I identified with the way that you thought. And eventually one day it happened where I'm like, oh, I'm an alcoholic. Now, when I say I'm an alcoholic, I want to explain to you what that means to me. Alcoholism, it affects me in a threefold manner: physical, mental, and spiritual. Let's talk about physical. On the physical side of things, I have what our book describes as a phenomenon of craving. I remember my sponsor taking me through the big book, and he'd always stop and ask me questions. And he said, you know what a phenomenon is, right? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, okay, what? And I'm like, well, you know. He's like, yeah, I know. I'm asking you if you know. And I'm like, well, it's like Bigfoot or UFOs and things. And my sponsor, I swear to God, he developed his own case of whiplash just because of you rolling his eyes back in his head at the dumb things I would say. And he's like, now we're not talking about Bigfoot or UFOs. We're talking about an indescribable urge to continue drinking once you start. In a much simpler way, there's an old proverb that I think describes my whole story. Man takes a drink, then the drink takes a drink, then the drink takes the man. That's it. That's my story. I start drinking and something happens to me. So I always go out with such good intentions of just getting there, just having three, just having six, just having whatever. And then after you get there, what are you doing? Going on maintenance, right? I'm going on maintenance, except that never happens for me. And I never stick to the plan. And I came to discover that that's because there's something biologically, physically wrong with me, with the way that I break alcohol down. Now, this doesn't mean that none of this is my fault. But it does mean that once I start drinking, if you want to know what a craving is, by the way, we're all subject to them all the time. We just don't always know where or how to look. But take a big, giant, deep breath and then hold your breath till the end of this talk. I guarantee you, after about 60 seconds, you will start to develop and feel what a craving for air feels like. And that's what it's like when I start drinking. When I start drinking, something happens. The other way of describing it is an allergic reaction to alcohol. And I like that. I like things when they're kept simple. Allergy, I can get my head around. I still can't fully get my head around phenomenon of craving, but I can get my head around allergy. And an allergy, if let's talk about a different kind of allergy. If I was allergic to bananas and every time I ate bananas, I broke out in red hives, right? Pretty straightforward. How far down the rabbit hole do you think I go with that? Do you really think I'm out there switching brands? Hey, you know what? Chiquita bananas, I seem allergic to them, but I'm sure Dole bananas will be different. No, I'm not doing that. I don't lie to people. I don't keep bananas in the house in case someone stops by and wants a banana. I don't want to be rude. I don't lie to my family and say I'm going for a walk so I can run down to the market and buy a bunch of bananas or whatever you call it. Is it a bunch of bananas? I don't even know. I don't keep a banana in my glove box so I can run out there at noon all warm and mushy and eat it and scarf it down, so I can get through the day and deal with them. I don't do any of that stuff. I just quit eating bananas and I go on about my business. So it begs the question, far worse things happen to me when I drink alcohol than just breaking out in hives once in a while. Why can I not stay away from alcohol? What is this strange, peculiar mental twist that I have? And that leads me into the second part of my illness, this mental obsession of the mind to drink alcohol. Again, I didn't even know that I had it. I just thought I was weak-willed. But I have a mind that, the way it was explained to me, will block out all of the ideas on why I'm not supposed to drink, for the insane idea that it will be different this time. And that's, I've done it many, many a times, because I got to tell you, it's always a sober mind that leads me back to drinking. So why then? What happens? I went through a phase where I decided that, hey, the best chance for me to sober up is to tell everyone, get the court of public opinion on my side and tell everyone that I am, I'm no longer drinking. And so that's exactly what I did. I told people that didn't even know me that, hey, I'm don't drink, don't even offer me any alcohol anymore. And so I was in this car, we were taking a road trip to Minneapolis. Literally when I was sitting next to this cooler beer, the minute we got out of the city limits, I reached into that cooler, grabbed a beer and cracked it. And my buddy who was driving, you know, he's trying to help. He's like, hey, I thought you quit drinking. I'm like, yeah, not on road trips though, my God. And that made perfect sense to me, right? By the way, the kind of people I drank with made perfect sense to them too. You know, yeah, that'd be extreme. And that off I go, right? A sober mind that always brings me back, that always cons me into telling me how it will be different this time. And that in and of itself is an extremely deadly illness. I have a mind that tells me I can drink and a body that tells me I'm not supposed to, and I will die from it. Haven't even gotten to the third part, right? The third part is this spiritual malady. This for me is really where the battle is won or lost. This spiritual malady, I've been describing it for the last 30 some minutes. It's this feeling of incompleteness I've always had. See, I've always had this feeling that there's this missing piece of me, this hole in my soul. And I've never known what it was or where it came from. And I have mistakenly thought that perhaps it was a money-shaped hole, a sex-shaped hole, a shopping-shaped hole, a prestige-shaped hole, or whatever. I've come to believe that it's a God-shaped hole. And ultimately for me, if you leave me without drinking and do not give me a viable solution, I will always resort to my natural state, which is increased feelings of restlessness, irritability, and discontentment. Restlessness in the sense that I don't know what kind of life I'm supposed to be living. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing, but this doesn't feel like it. I'm not doing the right job. I'm not with the right person. I just am always wanting to tinker with my life, and it never really feels fulfilling or satisfying. Irritable. I feel like I do twice as much as everyone else to get half the results, and I'm sick of it. I'm tired of feeling this way. My sponsor, when I was new, he said, you have a lot of self-pity. I, of course, argued with him. I'm like, no, I don't sit around crying all the time. That's not me. And he's like, I'm not talking about sitting around crying all the time. I'm talking about a deep-seated belief. Self-pity is a deep-seated belief that your life is harder than other people. Yeah, totally. I have. That's not even a belief. That's a truth for me. Yes, I have that. And I get very, very irritable, right? And that's why some of you maybe have had this as well, but many a times I've been diagnosed with some kind of anger disorder because I'm so mad all the time. I have such a chip on my shoulder and I don't know what to do with any of that. And then lastly, I'm discontent. Nothing holds its shine for me very long. And when things lose their shine, I react very immaturely. And I decide that this isn't it either. You know, I've done a lot of workshops in AA. And one time I was somewhere and they're like, hey, just do whatever you want to talk about. I made this workshop up. I've never done it since. But the title of the workshop was This Isn't It Either. And it was just a series of things where I once upon a time thought, hey, this is it. This job, this girl, this much money, this whatever. Ultimately, all ending at the same path of this isn't it either. Right? No matter what I do, it seemingly becomes discontent to me. I get a new car. I get a new little red sports car and I drive around and for a month, I feel really good in that car, right? Because I'm that fickle. I literally feel more confident based on the kind of car I'm driving. But one day I pull up to a stoplight and somebody pulls up in the same exact car, only theirs is black. And I think I should have got the black one, right? Nothing holds its shine very long. So I'm restless, irritable, and discontented. And unless I can experience a psychic change, a spiritual awakening, a personality change sufficient enough to bring about recovery from alcoholism, cast aside old ideas and beliefs for a completely new set, call it whatever you want, But unless I find a way to tap into something that's bigger than me, I am doomed to die from this slowly, usually. I'll say something that's probably going to be a little controversial, but the people who go out and drink and die suddenly, they're probably the lucky ones. Because normally for us, alcoholism is a very slow, painful, degrading death. It robs you of everything and it hurts everyone who's ever had the misfortune of loving us. And it takes that and kills those relationships. My sponsor describes it as, it's like being kicked to death by rabbits. It is an extremely unpleasant death that lies before us. But luckily, there is a different path that we can get on. And when I was 21 years old, I was grateful and fortunate enough to find that. And that was to come into the doors of AA. I did not want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have tried everything else. It was truly the last door on the hallway. And I'm wondering, you know, when that young lady who recommended or suggested, who's celebrating 6 days, I would guess it's similar. It's not, hey, I got a little too drunk last night. I think I better run to Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody does that. We try everything else, right? We go to treatment centers and doctors and I take tests and I get on medications and I do all of this stuff to try and figure out what's wrong with me. And finally, one day I stumble into AA. I sit down, I listen, right? The best growth I've ever had has always started with me listening. My sponsor told me a long time ago, he's like, Jeff, you've got 2 ears, 2 eyes, 1 mouth. Why don't you try listening and observing twice as much as you're yapping? And because I was always talking. And let me tell you, I never get better from talking. As I say that, speaking in AA. But that's not the path to spiritual growth for me. Inconvenience, love, tolerance, those are the things that lead me to spiritual growth. Anyway, so I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I identified with the people here. And then if you can have that identification, that's a great gift. It allows you to sit all the way down and occupy your seat. But then you can get the real gift, the real tangible gift, which is hope. Hey, you know what? I'm just like you. You guys all seem to have found a way out. You seem to have found a way to enjoy yourself and want to be sober. Maybe, just maybe, I could have the same thing. And when I looked around at the people who seemingly wanted to be sober, there were some common denominators, right? Irrespective of what their actual opinions or stories were. Most people seem to agree on sponsorship and having one. Most people seem to agree on having a home group and getting involved in it. Most people seem to agree that we should be attempting in some way, shape, or form to work the 12 steps, preferably the way it's outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Abiding by the traditions, trying to be of service, trying to be involved. And that's exactly what I did, is I just kind of dove in. I got a sponsor. My sponsor was about to set a foundation for me, not of my own making. I'll tell you, this is just me, just my experience. I don't mean to offend anyone, but there's an expression, somebody, maybe you have it in Virginia, we have it up here, but I'm like, that does not apply. And they'll say, take what you want and leave the rest, right? And I understand why they're saying it. I do not get the luxury of taking what I want in AA. Let me tell you what I would take. I will take AA dances. I will take 13th step in. I will take sponsoring women. I will take spending more money than I have. I will, whatever it is. But I'm certainly not going to take amends, admission of powerlessness, any of that crap, sponsor getting his nose in my business. I don't have the luxury to take what I want. What I need to do is do all of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Especially the inconvenient parts. And that's what a sponsor did for me. He didn't give me the luxury of taking what I want. I've been pursuing comfort most of my life. Really, truthfully, if you look back, even in AA, by the way, I will tell you that most of the time, and this is true of a lot of us, I'm not really after recovery. What I'm after is relief. You know where you can spot that is in your prayer life. God, please help me get over this. I'm not asking so I can be beneficial to the newcomer. I'm asking because I just want to feel better or look better to someone else. And so I've got to get away from this comfort-driven, relief-seeking attitude that I bring to life and move towards recovery, move towards character building, which are not attractive. They sound good at a podium, but they're not attractive things to actually do. And my sponsor pushed me into being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, had to join his home group. Got involved there, had to have a commitment. Couldn't even be a member apparently without a commitment. I was the greeter, right? My job was to stand at the door and welcome people into the meeting. First of all, the meeting started at 8:00. I had to be there at 6:30, which seemed ridiculous. But my sponsor was like, no one's hand can, you know, everyone's hand has to be shook. So you got to be here early. And I'm like, all right. And I was a horrible greeter. I got to tell you, I mean, because this is me. I'm standing there. I'm brand new. You know, and I'm like, hey, welcome to the meeting. Sucks. We can't drink. But, you know, here we are. And that's my idea of greeting at an AA meeting, right? But looking back, maybe the new people kind of, maybe they identified, I don't know. And I just took the actions that my sponsor told me to do. I would sit near the front because it was easier to pay attention. I wanted to sit in the back and make snide comments about the speaker or whatever. And I didn't get the luxury of doing that. They would trick me into doing things. They would tell me that we're speaking at the hospital on Saturday night. And that, you know, we're all meeting at my sponsor's house at 5:00. That seemed early because the meeting's not till 8:00, but I, you know, figure we're going to greet for 3 hours like idiots. And then I would get in his car and next thing I know, we would be driving out of town. And I'm like, what the hell? I thought we were speaking, you know, at the hospital. I'm like, yeah, we are. It's in Bismarck, 100 miles away. And, you know, now I'm trapped in this car. And I remember I was thinking to myself, man, this is Saturday night. I'm in the car with these four idiots. And I'm like, my life couldn't possibly get any worse. I was wrong. Let me tell you, Chris, who's sitting up front, who's just on fire with AA, you know, the type, and they just make you gag. And Chris is up front. He's like, I've made up a game for this road trip. And I'm like, oh shit. And Chris pulls out a copy of As Bill Sees It. And he's like, I'm going to read from this book, As Bill Sees It. And then we'll guess what it's from. Is it from the big book, 12 and 12, the letter Bill wrote, you know, who the hell knows? And I'm like, oh God, no. And I'm thinking to myself, pull this car over right now. Whatever small amount of dignity I have left, pull this car over and let me out in the ditch, because I am not wasting my Saturday night playing the what the hell did Bill write this in game. I refuse, right? I just refuse. And that's what I thought. That is not what I said. And that's an important distinction. I'll tell you, if there's one magic lesson I've ever learned, it's that AA doesn't care what I think. AA doesn't really care how I feel. It certainly doesn't care about my opinion. Alcoholics Anonymous cares what I do. If you want to stay here, if you want to make it here, train your feet to do the right thing. I cannot stress this enough. You've got to train your feet. I'm going to tell you something. I debate, I wasn't going to say anything, but because somebody told me a couple weeks ago, we were talking and they're like, no, nobody needs to get up anymore and talk about that they don't like COVID, right? That's not, oh, really? I love it. I think it's been fantastic. We also understand that Zoom is not the same. We don't need to berate Zoom and talk about how it's not the same. We get it. We're all aware of this. Kathy, for your benefit, we used to meet in person back in the old days, and hopefully we'll again someday. But yeah, we get it. COVID sucks. Zoom not as cool, whatever. But I'll tell you the real problem with Zoom is you don't have the energy transference that you normally have speaking at a meeting. I'm sure we've all spoken at a meeting. And there's an energy exchange that happens between us. That's the power, in my opinion, of when we get together. Zoom doesn't have that. Zoom allows us to hear some good people. And so especially if you're doing a lot of talking, it's my fourth night in a row of doing Zoom talks. And I'm feeling it. I'm feeling the burn. And I'll be honest with you, as the day went on, I was looking at the clock and I'm like, oh my God, I've got to talk again tonight. And speaking of which, I got a message from somebody asking me to talk right there. I've got to talk again tonight and I am tapped. I'm just done, right? I'm just done and I don't want to do it. That's fine. I can think that all I want. I can think, oh my, nobody's ever talked four nights in a row in the history of AA, blah, 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 which is of course ridiculous. And how tired I am and how special my circumstances are and blah, blah, blah. As long as at 5:40, I get up, I walk back here, I put on my tie, because that's what I've been taught to do. As long as my feet are doing the right thing, I'll be okay in AA, right? I'll be okay. And that's one of the many things that I was taught here through the just tremendous examples that reside in our program. And over the last 28 years, I've had a lot of different beliefs. Look, I'll tell you, don't chisel your beliefs in AA in marble, write them in pencil. Allow yourself to be open-minded and grow, because I promise you what you think at 5 years, at 10, you'll be like, I was such a dumbass at 5 years. I don't even know what to say. And I'm hoping in 10 years from now, and I'm 38 years sober, I'm like, man, at 28, I was talking in Virginia. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But now I'm a spiritual giant at 38 years. I'm growing. My opinions have changed, but there are some core beliefs that never really have gone away, and I've never altered them. I have always had a sponsor. I have always had a home group, and I try and stay involved in it. I have always tried to do something where I am giving back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think everyone needs to sponsor people. And again, that may be controversial. I do think we all need to work with others though. And I think sometimes we get those two things mixed up. Sometimes working with others leads to sponsorship, but it doesn't have to. I do have to, as I rush to the meeting and I see my friends, right? And I'm comfortable talking to them. That's fine, I can do that. But do a scan of the room. Who looks uncomfortable? Who looks new? Whether they are or not, doesn't matter. Who looks new? Invite them into your circle. Just these little tiny things that I can do to make things a little bit better and to try and pay it forward. Had a lot of things happen to me, of course, in my time in AA. I've had some really big successes and some really giant failures. I think sometimes we get caught up. I have to remind myself, I'm not a recruiter for AA. I'm certainly not a salesman. I'm just a guy sharing his experience. And sometimes I don't want to share the negative stuff. Why not? What I was promised was not a life beyond my wildest dreams. I was promised life. That's exactly what I've been given here. Now, I will admit it's a much better life because when I apply the principles and the lessons that I've learned in AA, things seem to go pretty well. So at 28 years sober, I've been married now I've been with the same woman. I finally found a woman who had what I've been looking for, which was an interest in me. That's a really attractive quality. And so I married that poor woman. And we've been married for 24 years. We had 3 kids now, 20. In fact, they're all here, 21, not living here. Just they all came to visit. They all find out when I'm speaking somewhere in the bedroom. And then that's when they come visit. So I have a 21, a 20-year-old and a 13-year-old who still lives here. And I've been blessed. You know, I was told once upon a time that I would have to be heavily medicated to function in a society. And I believed them. And I'm happy to report that's not been the case. I remember once upon a time thinking that I'm such an angry individual. Man, I was scared to have kids because what kind of a horrible father am I going to be? I can tell you now, one day at a time, doing the things we do here, I've been a really good father. And I don't say that in a braggadocious way. I just say that I have never, ever lost my temper with my kids. And believe me, they've done a lot of things that I could have, but I've changed. I've changed here because of the things that we do here, because of the things that you've taught me. I want to give you a couple of stories and then I don't know what we do after that break or something. But more recently, I like to share recently. I'm what I call a current share. Sometimes people like to have 10 year buffers between when they were an idiot and 10 years later, that's acceptable. I just want to share things as they happen. And in fact, nothing turns me off more than somebody who refers to their defects of character, past tense. You know, I used to be selfish and fearful back in the 90s. It's like, what the hell? I still have all my defects right now with me, trust me. Perception problems, you know, just all this goofiness. It's just manageable, right? So anyway, as I said, I think I told you, last month I turned 50. I don't look a day over 49, I'm told, so I'm really happy about that. But last month I turned 50, and when you turn 50, you have to have certain procedures. And specifically, they want to look inside your body with cameras, and they go up through areas of your body that nothing should go up. And so I have to have this colonoscopy. And now, independent of this, there's a nurse who works for our endoscopy department who he retired last year, and he's just putzing around, and they call him into work on this day. He was supposed to work till noon that day, and he's like, yeah, sure, I got nothing to do, I'll come in. He works till noon, he's getting ready to leave. The doctor grabs him and says, would you be willing to stay for one more appointment, and then I think we'll get caught up? And he's like, yeah, fine. So he stays, he looks on the list, he sees that my name, he comes out into the lobby where I'm waiting, and it turns out that this is a guy I've sponsored for 15 years. And I didn't know he was working. And by the way, the point of this story is to show you how God works in my life and how AA works in my life, because there's two distinct lanes. Now, as it turns out on this test, I'm not gonna get great news. and it's going to be really important to me. I mean, I was nervous kind of to begin with, and then to top it off, they're going to find something that they don't like. We're going to wait a week for biopsy results and all this stuff. And all the while, I sponsor the nurse who was in the procedure with me and could call him every night just to level set with where am I at, what's going on, what can I be doing. And it's a funny thing, a guy I've poured myself into for the last 15 years, suddenly I'm drawn from, right? And that's exactly how God works. He puts the right people in my life at the right time. And it's always been that way. As it turns out, by the way, the end of that story is my results came back aggressively precancerous. I told a coworker at work that, and he's like, oh man, I'm so sorry. You know, he starts kind of tearing up. He's like, if there's anything I can do, I'm like, precancer means no cancer, just so we're clear. I know it sounds scary. It's actually kind of a good thing. And now I've got to go in and have another procedure. Anyway, but the God in my life, and I could tell you lots of stories where it's just these little weird coincidences, these little things that can't be explained, whether the person's right there, the phone call that you needed to hear, whatever it happens to be. That has been the God that I have found and cultivated a relationship with here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the AA side of things, right? So I told you that the nurse, this is a guy, I went in for this procedure. He was there with me. It was fantastic. Beautiful story. Two nights later, by the way, keep in mind the tension that's going on in my house. Two nights later, we're waiting on biopsy results. Very stressful if you've ever had to do that, waiting to see if something's cancerous. I'm getting ready for bed. And my wife is like, what is that? And I'm like, what? She walks over to me on my right cheek of my derriere. This guy has written a heart with his initials on my butt in permanent marker. While I'm out, he vandalizes his sponsor while I'm out for this procedure. Guy's going to rot in a special AA hell, let me tell you. Yeah, you guys are laughing almost as hard as all the other guys I sponsor laughed when I told them this last weekend at my retreat. And that is how AA works, right? I have this God. He sends this unlimited line of court jesters, buffoons, misfits that we know as Alcoholics Anonymous. And those are the people. And that's where I belong, right? That's my people. I'll tell you something I learned a long time ago. If I leave here tonight and I decide, you know what, I'm not doing AA anymore. I'm going out drinking, the hell with it. You think I'm looking for normal drinkers? You think I'm looking for people who sit and stir their drink on end? No. I'm looking for alcoholics. I'm looking for people who drink like I do. I will be with you one way or another. It's either out there or in here. There's no other choice for me. This is the softer, easier, more beautiful way, let me assure you. We have fun. We are goofballs. We laugh at things you're not supposed to laugh at. You know, I love that line in the book about some people would be shocked at our levity or whatever it says. Yes, of course they would. But we're people who've been freed from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, been given a second chance. Things that other people take for granted, we don't, right? Little things. We cry at things that other people laugh at and laugh at things other people cry at. Somebody comes into our thing and I just got fired from a job. We all laugh. 2 weeks later, they come back. I'm taking a chip and I just got a job. We all cry, right? That's the way AA works. And in this, we pursue happy, joyous, and free. And a few years ago, and I'll close with this. A few years ago, I'd gotten it into my head. I wanted to figure out, what does happy, joyous, and free really mean? I understand freedom, got freedom from the bondage of self, freedom from the mental obsession of the mind to drink alcohol. But what is happy and joy? What's the difference between those two things? And it took me a while to find the answer. And it wasn't until my son at the time was like 15, and he really wanted this laptop for Christmas. And so we had told him that we couldn't afford it. You know, it's that kind of thing. But of course, we got the laptop. Wrapped it in an oversized box to throw him off the trail. And when that night came, when we opened the gifts, it's that gift that you put in the corner. It's the last one that you open. And when the moment came, when my son opened up this laptop and when the realization of what he had gotten, that he'd gotten the laptop he wanted, the look on his face was pure happiness, right? And then I looked over at his mother's face, and the look on her face watching him was pure joy. And it was at that moment I finally understood what AA gives us, right? We get to be happy and joyous. Happy. Sometimes things go your way. Sometimes every light is green. Sometimes the boss calls you in to tell you good job. Sometimes the person that you're interested in is interested back at you. And those are all wonderful things to be happy about. But joy, this idea of watching, speaking of cancer, I have a guy I sponsor who was not as fortunate in his diagnosis, and he had surgery for a tumor to be removed out of his tongue. And last week he had it on Monday, and on Thursday it's his call time. And he had told me he wasn't going to be able to speak for 3 months. And he called me on Thursday, and I right away, I couldn't believe his number was coming up on my phone. And I answered the phone, and there he was talking. And he was happy. I was joyful. You know, if you've ever heard someone talk about, if I would have made a list of things I wanted when I got here, I would have sold myself short. I used to think, really? What the hell? I would have made a pretty cool list. I wouldn't have known to list things like joy, self-fulfillment, pride, lack of fear running my life. I wouldn't have known how to ask for any of those things. And so I'm really grateful that we get to be on this program, not only for the freedom it affords us, but the idea that we get this happiness and this joy. And it is truly a privilege to be a member of this fellowship. It's a privilege to be with you tonight in Virginia. And with that, I am going to pass. Thank you and God bless.
Oh, thank you so much, Jeff. That was amazing. I'm going to allow everyone to unmute momentarily, and thank you.
Good, good. Share.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Love to share.
By rabbits.
Thanks, Jeff.
Appreciate Thanks, it, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, sir, very much. Thank you, sir.
All right, I'm going to grab the meeting back. We'll give Jeff a moment or two to exhale. We'll do some business here. I'm going to share that link again. The seventh tradition in AA states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Also, while the basket's going around, remember this is a Ask It Basket format. So please, any question you'd like to ask Jeff, just chat that to Larry at the user questions. Contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses. The seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements tonight for the good of AA? I will allow you to unmute yourself. Anybody? Alrighty then. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you to not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here in this room, in this spot, in this place. After we close the meeting, please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All righty. So let's see if we got some questions rolling in. Jeff, thank you so much. That was amazing. We got the first question is, how do you avoid drifting into worry, remorse, and morbid reflection?
Love, 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 love that question. So just for anyone who's curious, it's a question, you probably all know this, but it's a question that comes up in our 11th step inventory. And I'll tell you why this is important. I think that step three gets a lot of juice, a lot of love, but step three really is just about explaining a condition. Specifically, they're trying to explain to selfish and self-centered people, hey, you're selfish and self-centered. And it's almost like they knew we weren't going to agree or like that, hence the fourth step comes along to kind of prove that point. But anyway, the the 11th step, in my opinion, is where we carry out the decision we made in step three. And we do so through three methods. There's this nighttime inventory. There's this check-in throughout the day, pausing when agitated or doubtful and turning to God. And then there's, of course, the morning ritual where I want to give God a chance to come into my life. So in the nighttime inventory, I get into bed, and I'm going to be really honest with you. This is something I'm working on right now. I've gone through periods where I've done really, really well with the 11th step. And then I don't know if anyone else has this, but sometimes I do. You know how drunks are so horrible. You know how when you start taking medicine when you're sick, and you know how the doctors always stress, take it to the very end. I'm convinced it's alcoholics are the reason that they have to say that. Because the minute I start feeling better, I'm not doing this anymore. And I've done that, unfortunately, with my spiritual things as well. So now, sorry, finally to get to what you actually asked about. And during the course of that, I want to ask myself some questions. Was I loving and kind towards all? Did I look at what I could pack into the stream of life? And then it talks about drifting into morbid reflection. I tend to be a guy, first of all, I have never done this. I have never said, yeah, I went off and I thought about that, and I'm really glad I did. I really am coming out in a better spot than when I went in. But not only do I don't just spin, I spiral, right? The more I think about me, the more I obsess about me, the worse things tend to get. And just always is the case. If you really want to get into a depression, go lock yourself in a room by, and just think about your life for an hour. And I will start to go down. Now, why do I do this? Why do I morbidly reflect? I believe that my morbid reflection is just one more way for me trying to play God in my own life. It's me trying to run the show. And that's really the problem here. This really, if you want it in a nutshell, is about taking a selfish, self-centered individual and trying to slowly make him or her others-centered, even if it's just for a little while. And that's the trick. And when I get morbidly reflective, so for example, if I'm going through my day today, was I kind and loving towards all? Well, I did pretty good. I did cut this guy off in traffic. I probably shouldn't have done that. Now that I think about it, I told a little white lie to this guy, whatever, blah, 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 the case may be. Well, if I'm not careful, I can quickly slip down that hill and what's the point? I'm not doing A right. Everything I do is wrong. And I start to become morbidly reflective, which defeats the purpose of what I'm trying to do. It's just another side of the coin of me thinking about myself too much. So the simple answer to how I avoid it, A, is I try and catch myself at night when I'm going through the 11-step inventory. But B, I need to be putting myself in a position where I am thinking of others. I sometimes ask people in A, I'm like, do you live a life of helping others or thinking of others? And people, what's the difference? And either one is fine, of course, but there is a difference. Helping others would imply this. Dave's moving on Friday night. He asks me to help him. I say, yeah, sure, Dave, I'd love to come over and help you. I'm living a life where I help others. If I'm living a life where I'm thinking of others, Dave doesn't even need to ask me, I offer. Dave, I heard you're moving. I heard you're going on Friday night. I'd love to come over and help you. And what I'm not saying that that's perfect, but that's what I need to be striving to do, is how much am I fitting myself to be of service to people? How much am I thinking of others? And the reason I want to do that is not because I'm a nice guy, not because I want Dave to like me, not because I want Dave to ask me to speak somewhere. I need to do that to give this self-obsession that I have a bit of a break. It's like I have this periscope, right? And it's always on me, right? So no matter where I turn or go, there I am. And what I need is Alcoholics Anonymous to turn it back and to start to look towards you and where I can see you. And when I'm caught up in morbidly reflective thoughts, it's basically a fancy way of saying I'm overanalyzing myself. I lose track of that. Now, if I may, I'll give you the other part of what I think maybe that question, it didn't specify this, but I would guess if you're like me, the other problem and the question that comes up is, why are we so hard on ourselves? I am so hard on myself. I never seem to give myself a break. Once again, this is me trying to avoid any kind of real consequence for my action. It's me telling God and the universe, hey, listen, I will punish myself. I will be super hard on myself. I'm not giving myself a break. Trust me, I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to lash myself plenty. But I would rather overcommit on punishing myself and still be in control than I would trust myself sometimes to a merciful God. That's literally the depths of how bad I want to be in control of my life. So hopefully I answered your question.
So since we're on the topic of the 11th step, do you see sort of a connection between the 10th step and the 11th step throughout the day? What's your 10th step look like?
Great question. Yeah. I think sometimes, it's kind of a pet peeve of mine. I think people get these mixed up. I think people oftentimes think that the 10th step is what you do at night. But when I'm sitting at a light at 8:30 in the morning, resentful at the guy who sped up over and passed me and got in front of me, I can't wait till tonight to work the steps on that guy. So 10th step is a right now step. 10th step is literally a reworking of 4 through 9. What am I resentful about, fearful of? Who am I harmed? I run it through the columns. If I need to, I talk to someone. Am I ready to have God remove whatever defect of character I've identified in myself? I humbly ask him to. And then, of course, I promptly make amends. I think the 10th step has to be more of a how I fit myself into society. The 10th step is where they talk about we don't have a cure for alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. What is the maintenance of my spiritual condition? It's a constantly watching. Because one thing I don't think gets stressed enough is these things will come back. I don't care how wonderful your 5th step was or how profound your 7th step prayer was. These things creep back in. I have to always, the problem with resentments, by the way, is they don't come back looking like resentments. You know, it's like resentment went out and bought a disguise and sneaks its way back into my life. The fake mustache and stuff. It's like, oh yeah, come on in. You seem welcome as I'm watching for resentment because they don't look. I've never said that before. That's so ridiculous. Because they don't look like resentments anymore. They look like truth. So I don't even see them as resentment, especially the longer I've been sober. When you're 20 years sober, you're not resentful at that guy. He's just an asshole. That's just the way it is. And I couldn't possibly be resentful. I'm too spiritual. And so I have to constantly be watching for those things. And I have had to make so many amends for behaviors that I have done as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, conversely, step 11 throughout the day is where I turn to God. My sponsor has a great line, and it's really true. If you want to know what your higher power is, what did you spend the most time thinking about today? That's your higher power. Was it God? Was it her? Was it money? Was it football? Was it whatever? I mean, I've had some really weird higher powers by that definition. So how much time am I really giving to God? Because when you read our 11th step, I mean, it's really quite simple. Get up in the morning. Spend a little time allowing God to get involved in my life, check in with him throughout the day, turn to him, pausing, especially when agitated or doubtful. And that pause is where I usually can find the God, right? Because oftentimes I want to say things or shoot an email off or put up a drama-laden Facebook status or whatever. And then, of course, at night I want to go to bed and I want to see how I did. And the importance of the nighttime inventory is that it will carry over into my next day. I'll tell you right now, a bold statement, but if you want to change where you're at right now, I promise you, do that 11th step inventory on page 86. Do it for 30 days. I guarantee you, I'll leave my number. You can call me if it doesn't work. I guarantee you that you will feel different about yourself and your recovery in just 30 days. Actually, it won't even take that long. It is amazing how that little simple action can have such long-term big effects. And yet I still have to be told to do it after all these years. That's the insanity, one of the insanities of alcoholism.
Yeah, me too. I was struck by, I love the way that you phrase things, but I love the abandonment of comfort seeking. What I wrote down was comfort seeking / convenience driven. And I just love the way you phrase that. And I think that's all I want to say about that, but I'm wondering if there's any more in there, any more meat on the bone there.
No, sorry, I'm not laughing at you, David. I'm just, God bless alcoholics. Well, I've been in a lot of these ask baskets and Q&As and stuff. You'll have someone stand up. I don't really have a question. And then they'll just go on to either say something, literally contradict what you just said or something. You're not doing that. It just made me think of it. Yeah, I think, like I said, I mean, it was a powerful observation for me. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is contrary to my nature. That's why not everyone gets it. Even though we stress how simple it is, there's a great line in Bill's story that doesn't get talked about that I think should. You ever heard the old expression, AA is for fun and for free, right? And what they mean, of course, is there's no monetary dues or fees for Alcoholics Anonymous. But make no mistake, there is a price. And in Bill's story, he talks about it. He says, simple but not easy. It meant a price had to be paid, the destruction of self-centeredness. I got to tell you, that's a big price to pay. I would rather pay $30 a month for my membership in AA than the destruction of self-centeredness, because what does the destruction of self-centeredness look like, right? I don't mind being altruistic when it's appropriate, when I think it's my turn. Rarely do I think it's my turn, by the way. I don't mind doing it when I don't have anything else to do, but rarely is it convenient. But how many times, I can't tell you how many times I've sat down on a Friday night. Actually, this just happened last night. Last night, 10 o'clock, my wife and I left our own devices. We kind of, especially now in this world, we like to binge watch shows. And lately we've gotten on a kick. We've been binge watching these murder mystery shows. So this is kind of important. You got to stay up to speed. I got to figure it out, crack the case, right? All this. Last night at 10, phone rings. And I'll tell you something, if you start working with others, the phone literally has a different ring when it's them. It's the same ringtone, but you can just hear it. It's like, oh man. Right. And I look, and sure enough, it's some guy I sponsored. I've been on the phone with him 4 times since Thursday over a self-induced crisis that he caused. I've already given him all the advice I have. There's nothing more to talk about. He just wants to go on and on about it. And here's the bottom line. I'm sorry. I don't want to listen to it. I don't want to hear it. The hell with you. I'm watching Murder Mystery on Netflix. This is important stuff, right? All that's going in my head. But as I alluded to, I've trained myself. I don't listen to that part of it. Let me tell you when it was a big deal, when I was in the same jackpot and I was calling my sponsor. If he'd have told me, hey, I'm watching a movie, I'd have fired him so fast. I mean, I demand help when it's my turn in the wheel. And so you get on the phone and you listen. And there's another thing. Ego infiltrates my desire to be helpful. Here's my, okay, I'm going to be helpful. That means I'm spouting off pearls and explaining what Bill meant and giving some piece of history no one knows. Let me tell you what I picked up in Akron, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, all this. And that's not what 12-stepping really is. You want to know what 12-stepping looks like? It looks like this. You know, it's that. It's listening. But, excuse me. Apparently God's had enough of me talking. But I will pursue relief. I will pursue comfort. I mean, think about this. Sorry, I'm getting on a tangent, but Bill Wilson, right? We all know the story. He's in Akron. He's in the Mayflower Motel and he's pacing the lobby and he's contemplating having a drink, right? He's in a bad spot. His business has not gone well. How many of us, myself now, I definitely include in this, if we were in that spot today, if you were standing somewhere, if you were traveling in a hotel lobby thinking about drinking, would you call a newcomer? Would you call someone and say, hey, is there a newcomer here? Or would you call your sponsor or a friend? It's like we've gotten a little soft. And I'm not berating AA, but think about that. Bill Wilson's butt's on the line and he's calling a newcomer. I met a woman who was really good friends with Bill Wilson. And I asked her, I said, when Bill and Bob met, we all know Bob was going to bail after 15 minutes. They ended up being there for 4 hours. What did they talk about? What actually happened? You never hear about that. And she's like, oh, I'm so glad you asked. Bill wanted you to know this. I was so self-centered. I'm like, Bill wanted me to know? And then I realized she was talking about all of AA. But she talks about how Bill was sitting in this room and Dr. Bob came in, of course, skeptical. And Bill stood up, marched across the room, and he started vigorously shaking Dr. Bob's hand and thanking him for coming because Bill needed this so much. And I've thought to myself, how often do I take that attitude into my working with others? An ethic of gratitude. Somebody calls and interrupts a movie. Thank you. Thank you so much. Because I'm not getting, no, this is nothing. This is important, right? Or how many times am I just smug and glib about it? Yeah, look, you got 30 seconds and then I got to go do this, blah, 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 whatever the case may be. It's a work in progress, right? But I should strive to be, I mean, the highest level I'm looking for in Alcoholics Anonymous is servant. That's what I'm trying to become. And to do that, I'm not going to get there through comfort. I'm not going to get there through convenience. Service is difficult, right? I can always tell with guys I sponsor when they've started working with others, always, because they will always call with the same battle cry. I'm getting used. I'm getting taken advantage of. This guy doesn't appreciate me. Those are always the battle cries of someone who's lived their life through selfish and self-centered means and now suddenly is trying to do for others. There's always that heel of expectations that comes along for a little while. So I don't know if that, I don't even remember what the original question was, David, but I hope
that's beautiful. Somewhere perfect. There. Well, speaking of service, we have a question. How has service affected your sobriety and why is it important? If you feel it is.
I do feel it is. I'm actually on a kick lately of, it's actually really interesting because I'm in the middle of kind of making some changes, but I believe that if someone comes up to you, this is just opinion, but I think if someone comes up to you and says, what do you do for AA? I think you need to be able to have an answer and it's not, I stay sober. I need to know what lane do I occupy? What is it that I do for Alcoholics Anonymous? Now, you don't have to do everything, but you do need to at least have your foot, I think, in a couple of lanes. For me, service was something that I did a lot of when I was around 5 to 10 years sober. I was on the district and eventually the area, and I was a GSR for my group, and then I was a DCM, I think is what it was, and I did all of that. And then I kind of moved. Now, my lane, at least for right now, for the last 5 years or 10, my lane has been working with others. I really love that. I get a lot of joy out of that and speaking. I know I'll get branded as an egomaniac for saying that, but look, that's just been the case. I go out 26 weekends a year for Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I am actually in the middle of trying to change that. I'm kind of burnt out on it. And quite frankly, I just don't want to do it anymore. I just want to be an AA member here in Fargo. So I'm actually eyeing back up service in particular. We're starting a book study because I just want to kind of go back to the basics of what I consider Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to get caught up in all this pageantry of things. I just want to spend time with the guys I'm fortunate enough to be with here in Fargo, do a little book study, do our home group, try and make AA better, try and go on some 12-step calls. But service, I do sponsor a lot of people who are actively right now involved in service. In fact, I don't know if Virginia, this touches you or not. I know I sponsor a couple of people in New York. We're on the East Coast there. It's not unheard of that they'll have service sponsors. I've learned this concept up in Rhode Island where you'd have a sponsor who walks you through the 12 steps and then you'd literally have a service sponsor. And I have a couple of people that I currently sponsor who have service sponsors because apparently they think I'm not good enough for that or whatever. And I'm not. So that's fine. So short answer is, I think it's immensely important. I think that, being the coffee maker, you want be the coffee maker at your home group, right? And tell me how important that is by not making coffee 1 week after we're meeting. I mean, there's all kinds of things, but I do think the question of what do I do for AA? I need to be able to answer that. I need to be able to say, hey, this is my lane. This is my seat that I occupy. And this is what I do.
Awesome. Do you have any suggestions for improving on Rule 62? Which Rule 62 well, may need to be explained too.
I will. So Rule 62, if you are new, it means basically don't take yourself so seriously. And there's actually a story behind it. I don't know that. I remember hearing it. It was something to do something back in the old days where some idiot had gotten involved and had all these rules and ultimately it kept climbing. But we very much affectionately have adopted it as don't take yourself so seriously. And so for me, it was very easy. My sponsor told me a long time ago, he's like, you need to learn to laugh at yourself because everyone else is laughing at you. And, you know, that's harsh, but I'll tell you why it's important. And again, a lot of this comes back to the third step, I think. In the third step, when they talk about we are an actor trying to direct the whole show and arrange the lights and the pageantry, ultimately what it really boils down to is that I love to play God in my life and the people around me, right? I am so considerate that I get up and I write a script and a part for everybody. And if everybody would just abide by their lines and stick to the script, we would all be happy. One of the reasons that I don't see this as being such a problem is because I have such good intentions. I've lived most of my life thinking that good intentions should excuse bad actions. And of course, it doesn't work that way. We get judged on our intentions. But when I am playing God, it's a big job that I am not equipped for. And one of the byproducts that I can always tell when I've gotten too far into it is I start to become more and more serious. Always more and more serious when I'm overreaching, when I'm overstepping. Conversely, if I'm a guy who is armed with a higher power, who's going to be taking care of everything today, including running the universe without me, it allows me to free myself up. And again, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but in the 11th step at the end, have you ever noticed, I've always found this interesting, after they've gone through all of the to-dos on step 11, they say, we are then in much less danger of, and then they list off some adjectives, including excitement. First one they list, we are then in much less danger of excitement. And I've always thought, when the hell did excitement become, when does this become a problem? We haven't talked about excitement once up until this part of the book. And suddenly after step 11, thank God I'm not going to be excited anymore. But because of the fact, I believe I have made some of the dumbest decisions when I'm excited. I have made some of the almost what most people would call intoxicating type decisions when I am excited, right? And so there's another part. It says we don't tire so easily because we are no longer foolishly trying to burn up our energy, controlling everything. And I think for me, that's part of it, is when I can learn to laugh at myself. You know, these things that once you can start laughing at something, it can no longer hurt you. Conversely, if you hide it away in the dark, and I'll tell you, bad stuff grows best in the dark. It starts to morph into fears, that starts to morph into that morbid reflection we talked about earlier, into that little voice that says, if they only knew. This is why it's very important that my relationship with my sponsor is totally current. If I do something, whatever the case may be, and I justify out of, I'm not going to tell him this thing, it doesn't really matter, it's not really part of my alcoholism, whatever. Then later on, when he's giving me a suggestion that I desperately need to take, my mind's got that little wiggle room to get out of it. You know what? He doesn't know the full story. And if he did, he wouldn't be telling you to do this. And that's why it's important. So I try really hard to laugh at myself with the belief. And, you know, you just heard me share my story. I mean, I talk about, the suicide attempt with the vitamin C, which, by the way, I sometimes have people ask me, is that story real? It's like, yeah, it's real. This isn't a fictional account I wrote for AA meetings. But I'll tell you, when I was in it, it was not funny at all. If you'd have come to me that next day in that room and said, hey, by the way, you're going to fly all over the country and share this with rooms full of strangers, I would have thought, you need to be in the loony bin, not me. I'm never telling anyone about this. And there's been a lot of things that have happened like that, where I just need to learn I'm not that big a deal. I'm just not. I know my ego wants to think that it is, but I'm not. So laugh and enjoy yourself and don't take yourself so seriously, because life goes so much better when I'm in that frame of mind.
Is there a timetable on when I should start sponsoring others? Too soon, too late? Question mark.
Thank you. God bless this question. I'm going to tell you, it's an opinion. Absolutely not. I know that this has become the chic thing to do. You got to have a year. You know that we tell people, by the way, you know, you should wait to get into a relationship till you've had a year of sobriety. Why? What happens at a year? Now, I'm not suggesting you get in one sooner, but we somehow magically indicate that something will have happened. No, you can't transmit what you don't have. That's the big thing, of course, but sponsoring someone, number one, well, I'd sponsor the guy who we would go through the book and cover off on the step. Then he would literally drive to his sponsor's house and just regurgitate what he had just learned. I mean, it can be that fast. But I think that, yes, you cannot transmit something that you don't have. I get that. But if I'm waiting around till I'm ready to sponsor people, I will never be. If you look back in our history, none of them were ready to do anything. Bob and Bill got together and like, what the hell do we do now? I don't know. Let's go find this guy. And that's that painting that we see of those two 12-stepping that guy, the man in the bed. And nobody knew what the hell they were doing. They just were willing to give of their time. That's the key. Am I willing to give of my time? Am I willing to listen? And if I do start sponsoring someone and I don't know the answer, here's an idea. Say I don't know. I'm not sure what to tell you on this, but I've got a sponsor. He has a sponsor who has a sponsor. We'll find you the answer one way or another. But my big objection was always that, well, I'm going to screw him up. Let me tell you something. New people already are screwed up. I'm not going to make them any worse by any means. But I do believe this is the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think if someone asks, you know, tell them your story. Listen, I'm only 3 months sober or whatever you may be. I don't know a lot, but if you'd be comfortable, yeah, we can learn as we go and drop the ego and give of your time. Absolutely. I think that, you know, if you see people leave AA and you ask questions, you never hear this. You know, hey, why'd so-and-so leave AA? Oh, they started trying to help others too early, right? That's just not a reason people leave. And so trust me, it's not gonna affect you. So yeah, that's just my personal opinion. You could easily find 100 people to tell you differently, but I think they'd be wrong. So
that's awesome. We this has been a fast 90 minutes. I hope it was for you, Jeff. Before I let you go, I got one more question. I wonder if you'd just maybe do a minute or so on what being a member of a home group has meant to you.
Overall?
Anything you'd like to share about being a home group member?
Yeah, so my home group meets on Tuesday night, 7:30. It's a speaker meeting. That is my non-negotiable. One of the things, as soon as I get into trouble in A is when I start negotiating, should I or shouldn't I? I was given a really strong ethic. My home group, you do not miss unless there's a death in the family, yours. Now, over the years, I've softened a little bit on that. When I started to have kids and my kids started to have recitals and things, I wasn't going to miss that because I'm trying to be Superman in AA. But on the same token, I also had accountability with people I sponsor, my sponsor and all that stuff. But for the most part, I mean, any Tuesday night, you will find me at my home group at 7:30. I have nights where it's literally like 40 below on a Tuesday night. And I'm like, what the hell? I do not want to go train my feet to go. When I get there, I show up early. My meeting starts at 7:30. I'm not in my right frame of mind if I show up at 7:29. I have an obligation to greet people and meet people. So I show up there no later than 7. I don't dress down for my home group. I dress up out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is saving my life. That doesn't mean I have to be in a tie, but I shouldn't be in a tank top and shorts because I want to be comfortable either. I want to look presentable. I want to look sober. And then I want to stay late. I want to have a job in it. I want to be involved because what will happen if I don't do those things, my attitude will start to go south because even the best AA group in the world, it changes. You come in, these people understand me. They love me. They accept me. 5 years later, it's full of cliques, people who are insincere. It's the same group of people. I've just changed is all that's happened. So I really believe it's important to be immersed in my home group through action.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank everyone who participated, Larry for wrangling the questions, my co-host, my beautiful home group members. I'll remove the unmute after the Lord's Prayer to thank Jeff one more time. And I wonder if Leanne would read a vision for you.
Be happy to, David.
Thank you.
My name's Leanne. I'm an alcoholic. A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you. And we could all just virtually circle up, virtually hold hands. and actually pray the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Thank you, Jeff. That was amazing.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. It was really good. Much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, sir. That was a great speaker. Great.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
All right, everybody.
Just real quick, let's get back into the car where you're driving to Bismarck and you're playing the As Bill Sees It game.
I didn't finish it, did I?
You didn't finish it. I love the punchline.
I didn't finish it. That's right. Yeah. So I didn't say anything, of course. All I did was guess Grapevine every time and took second place. So I was really quite impressed with that. So, my sponsor was really, he's like, "You really know the Grapevine? You're damn right I do."
So, I love that story.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Thank you for speaking.
Yeah. Hey, David, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeff. We'll see you down the road, brother. Thank you so much. Go be with your kids.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. Bye. All right, everybody. I'm going.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, brother.
You know, worse. Later.